program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with a goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Naomi, and today I will be reading from A Place for Us by Nicholas Gage. The final chapter, Chapter 20, Journey's End. Something about being married and starting a family of my own made me realize that my father was an old man and wouldn't live forever. He had always seemed to me as indestructible as our mountains. But the fact was that he was 77 years old and I was 31. Until now, he had supported me as best he could, if not with money, then with encouragement and his faith in my future. He had even won over my sisters to a marriage that I knew threatened all the traditions he had taught us. Now his job was finished, and it was time for me to do something for him. I had a home and a good job, and I resolved to try to give my father three things I believed would bring him joy in the years he had left. His greatest wish was for two grandchildren to carry on his name and my mother's. To give him one that required Joan's cooperation and a lot of luck. But the other two gifts I could manage on my own. One was a new car. He had always owned used cars, coddling them through their cranky middle age. The other was a trip back to the country he hadn't seen since 1939. The place that had formed him and still had a strong grip on all of us. Fortune seemed to aid me in these efforts, for Joan became pregnant almost immediately after we settled into a small apartment on Manhattan's West End Avenue, and a book publisher offered me a sizable advance for a collection of my newspaper articles on the mafia. When I went home for the first time in first Christmas in 1970, I told my father I had good news. "Joan is pregnant," I said, "and you're taking a trip to Greece next summer." At first, the idea of returning after 32 years frightened him, but I persisted. The whole truth was, I secretly wanted him out of the country when Joan gave birth the following July. I knew how much my father longed for a grandson to carry on his name, but I was afraid that if our firstborn turned out to be a girl, his disappointment would be upsetting both to Joan and to me. "Why would I want to go back after so long?" he scoffed when he heard my offer. "All my comforts are here," but soon his enthusiasm blazed up, and he recalled his triumphant trips back to Leah in the 1930s, when he had reigned over the coffee house like a sultan and had gone on hunting trips for wild boar and quail on the highest peaks of the mountains. I began to have some qualms. "The village isn't like it was in the old days, Patera," I warned him. "You used to have a whole family to welcome you. Now everyone's old. You're not young and yourself anymore. After all, 78 isn't an age for chasing wild boar." "Don't worry about me," he retorted. "I don't need a young Americanaki to tell me about life in the village. I remember one time playing cards in the Cafe Neon for 3 days without sleep," and he was off again on a wave of nostalgia. When it was time to leave on April 11, 1971, my father arrived in New York with all his luggage, including an entire suitcase of toiletries, soaps, talcum powder, and dozens of changes of underwear to help him maintain his high standards of hygiene. "I don't want to be embarrassed by having to ask someone to clean my underwear for me," he explained. "So I brought enough to change my linens every day." He had driven his 1963 white Opel to leave with me for the duration of his trip, so that when Joan's time came, I could drive her across Manhattan to the hospital instead of having to find a taxi. As I drove him to Kennedy Airport on that warm April Sunday, he gave me advice on how to look after his car properly. When he was about to board the plane, he said, If anything happens and I should die over a cross, I don't want to be buried there. I want you to bring my body back to Worcester, to Hope Cemetery. My father's return to Greece was not a success. I had warned him to do as I had and stay in a hotel when he was in Athens, because to stay with a relative would lead to arguments and hurt feelings if he selected one person's house over another or become overly indebted to one family, who might then complain that he didn't give adequate gifts when he left. He followed my advice and stayed the first night at the Grand Bretagne, but the next day he moved into a crowded home of his nephew Yanni, announcing to the family that the maids at the hotel stubbornly insisted on making the beds with sheets, a practice he considered unhealthy because sheets made him feel cold. He himself always insisted on sleeping between two warm blankets. As a result of the sheets, he had caught a terrible cold, he said, and would never stay in a hotel again. As unmentioned factor might have been what he felt less at ease in the elegant, cavernous, antique-filled Grand Bretagne than he did in the crowded, noisy family home filled with women ready to bring him coffee, his slippers, and his glass of water. A small glass, he specified, never a large one, the way my sisters did at home. After reacquainting himself with relatives in Athens, my father set out for the village accompanied by Yanni. This was even more of a disaster than the Grand Bretagne. Since the death of my grandparents, Nitsa and Andreas had moved into the Hades house, but my aunt's housekeeping had deteriorated as she grew older, and her eyesight grew worse. She washed dishes and clothes carelessly, rarely swept, and allowed dust and soot to form a permanent patina on everything in the house. As soon as he set eyes on Nitsa, Father began to berate her for slovenliness and her treachery to his wife. My aunt returned the curses and insults as forcefully as he dished them out. Despite all of Andrea's attempts to act as peacemaker, Father soon stormed out of the house, declaring he would never set foot in it again. He went to the house of his brother Photo at the opposite end of the village and down a winding, treacherous footpath that teetered on the brink of a ravine. When my father confronted his ne'er-do-well brother, he lashed out at him too, reminding him of every misdeed throughout his misspent, lazy, selfish life, and ending with the accusation that by failing to share his food during the famine, and by leaving the village and abandoning Eleni and her children, as well as his own wife, Photo had been responsible for their deaths, and had consigned his black soul to hell. My father evidently had been stirring up these resentments and accusations for all the decades since my mother's murder, and the sight of the village and the faces of his derelict relatives caused an eruption of bitterness. Father took a taxi back to Yanina, where he armed himself with every sort of supply, lounge chair so he could sit under the grape arbor in the courtyard, a bottle of Petrogas to fuel the gas burner, water glasses in the small size he preferred, all sorts of food, even a wooden toilet seat to add comfort to the one-hole outhouse in Photo's yard. Then he returned to Leah. Back in America, I was bombarded with letters from aggrieved parties in the village. My father wrote describing his terrible treatment at the hands of Nitsa and his battles with his relatives. Nitsa wrote, dictating to Andreas because she was illiterate, that Father had shamed her before all the village by walking out and refusing to stay in her house. Uncle Photo complained that my father was imposing on his hospitality and insulting him daily. From New York, I tried to make peace between them. I sent money to my aunt, telling her to use it to hire a woman to clean her house. I wrote to my father, begging him to forgive old grievances and try to make peace with the relatives he still had living in the village, but to no avail. Father was sitting in the coffee house in the central square under the plane tree on July 17, 1971, when Joan gave birth by Caesarean section to a son, Christos. I immediately called my sisters, who wept with joy, that I too had escaped the Gutsiana's curse of producing only girls. Glyceria telephoned her father-in-law in Philiades, and he relayed the news to a local taxi driver who set out on the trip up the mountains to bring my father word of his grandson and namesake, certain that he would collect a handsome shariki, a reward for good news. He was not disappointed. At the panieri, 3 days later, my father threw money around like confetti, treating everyone to food and drink, liberally tipping the musicians who played as he danced in joy at his good news. Within days, a telegram arrived in New York from Greece, coming home early to see my grandson. We scarcely had our baby son installed in the second bedroom, recently converted from an office, when it was time for me to collect my father from the airport. He came off the plane, and I hugged him, and then asked somewhat apprehensively how he had liked Greece. He shook his head. "I was born there, all my children born here, there," he said wearily, "but my country is America. I'm glad to be home." I could tell he was close to exhaustion from his journey. When we arrived at our apartment, he went immediately to the baby's crib, placed a $50 bill on Christo's chest, and then pinned several gold phylacta charms to ward off the evil eye on the pillows around him. "That's a fine boy, my grandson," he said. "Now I need to lie down." It was important to my father that we observe tradition, even though we lived far away from Worcester, in a skyscraper in New York. He traveled to visit every December 6 for my name day and spent hours cooking in the pocket-sized kitchen. Then we would all sit around waiting for well-wishers to come. But he was always disappointed, for Joan and I could never muster more than a few couples who either were Greek or knew the name day traditions. I could see that it pained my father to have us living in this cold-hearted city where no one observed the feast day of St. Nicholas, while in Athens the streets were clogged with traffic as everyone visited all the Nicholases they knew. Father visited much more often than once a year. Whenever wanderlust hit him, especially during warm weather, he would board a Greyhound bus for New York. Once settled in our second bedroom, near the baby's crib, with all his necessities all arranged just so on the bedside table, he would venture out into the city, traveling down to the harbor to ride the ferry to Staten Island to visit the Greeks who owned the restaurant where he had worked as a chef during the Second World War. It made him proud that he could negotiate this great city on buses and ferry boats alone. After he sailed back to Manhattan, past the huge statue of St. Freedom, which had welcomed him and his children to America, he would continue up to the Greek district on 8th Avenue in the 40s. But he could never stay anywhere long, and the urge to return home always struck him as soon as he had arrived. Joan and I would wake up to find him fully dressed and packed, sitting on a suitcase, wearing his hat, his hands resting on his head of his walking stick, impatiently waiting for dawn so that he could head back to the Port Authority bus terminal and home. When he or my sisters weren't visiting us, we would drive to Worcester nearly every other weekend and stay in Kanta's or Glykeria's house. Submerging myself in the Greek life of my relatives, the feasts, dances, visits, and church services gave me strength to deal with the events that were rocking the city and my own career during the week. Drug raids, corruption scandals, and a series of mafia wars that erupted in New York in the early 1970s. By 1974, Greece was in the throes of political turmoil. The ruling military junta tried to assassinate the ruler of Cyprus, Archbishop Makarios, and in the ensuing chaos, the Turks invaded the island. The failure of the junta's colonels to stop this invasion caused the collapse of their regime and the return of democracy to Greece, events that generated daily news stories and worldwide interest in the country. I urged my editors at the Times to open a bureau in Athens instead of just having the Rome correspondent cover it from afar. My ulterior motive was to get assigned there so I could pursue my mother's story while being a foreign correspondent for the Times. After all, who else in the newspaper spoke Greek? But while they heeded my advice to open an Athens bureau, to my dismay, they assigned another reporter to the new post. When I went to A.M. Rosenthal to complain, he told me, "I don't understand why you want to leave New York for Athens, but you'll get the post next if it's so important to you." The delay probably was for the best, I realized, for Joan was pregnant again and we would be able to have the baby in this country. We continued our routine of visiting my family every other weekend, but because it was getting harder to crowd our growing family into Conta small house on these visits, I decided that we should buy our own place in the area. One day in early 1974, while visiting Worcester on my own, I saw a large 200-year-old colonial farmhouse with 3 acres of land in nearby town of Grafton, located conveniently close to the turnpike and selling at a bargain price. Joan and I had been looking for an old house like this one, which had a history dating back to the original settlers in 1722. But I wanted my father's opinion before I committed myself to paying such a large sum of money. I knew my sisters would hate the place because they had a mania for things that were brand new. Whenever Joan and I showed them the antiques we had picked up at flea markets and auctions, they always asked, "Aren't you making enough money yet to afford something new?" I drove my father over to see the house with its Greek Revival facade, wide pumpkin pine floors and fireplaces. His good customers in the days of his produce route had lived in such houses. "No, I don't need to see the second floor," he said warily, eyeing the steep staircase. "It's got a nice sunny porch. All I need is a comfortable chair. Buy it." On weekends and vacations, we struggled to make the rough beamed rooms comfortable, and during the week, I continued my reporting for the Times, consoling myself that I would finally get back to Greece in 1977. Our visits to Massachusetts were nostalgic journeys back into Greek culture. At Christo's third birthday party in our new old house, someone drove his car up on the lawn to play Greek music full blast on the tape deck, while dozens of guests roasted lamb, sang, and snake danced around the lawn, to the astonishment of our Yankee neighbors. 3 months later, on October 8th, Joan gave birth to our daughter named Elaney for my mother. The baby grew to resemble her grandmother so much, with the same large blue eyes, classic features, and honey-colored hair, that when we took her to Greece, village women often burst into tears at the sight of her. My father's joy touched everyone who saw it when he danced at Elena's christening on September 28, 1975. The guests all danced like dervishes, perspiring, shouting, throwing money at the musicians, and rolling on the floor as onlookers threw $20 bills at the best performers. But the star of the show were my father and his 11-month-old granddaughter in her lace christening gown, who held up her hands in imitation of her grandfather and danced in front of him as he led the line, glass balanced on his head, until he finally gave up to gather the tiny, solemn, dancing cherub into his arms. Soon after the baptism, I discovered that giving my father a new car was going to be even harder than producing a boy and a girl in sequence, or convincing him to go to Greece. "Why go to the expense?" he would say every time I brought it up. "My Opel is only 10 years old." One weekend, when I visited Worcester on my own, I picked up my father in a rented car and drove to Procopi's Pizza Parlor. As my father watched, we enacted a little charade I had rehearsed with my brother-in-law. Procopi scolded me for wasting my money on rental cars every time I came to visit, saying I should really have a car of my own. "But driving a new car in New York would ruin it," I protested. Eventually, Procopi convinced me to buy a new car, to leave it with my father for safekeeping, and to take his old Opel to New York because it wouldn't matter if something happened to it. Father was uncertain about parting with his beloved Opel, but as soon as I drove us to a car dealer on Route 9, he was drawn to a silver-gray Oldsmobile Omega, like an adolescent who has glimpsed at his first grand passion. "This is the one for you," he advised. "Nice lines, not too big, good space inside." "I don't know," I said uncertainly. "You don't need to know," he asserted. "You listen to your father. If there's anything I know, it's cars." That was how my father became the possessor of the sleek silver Omega, which he cosseted and doted on for the rest of his life. As the day approached for my departure to Greece, many fortunate omens seemed to be coming together. Joan gave birth to another girl on July 12, 1977, just 2 months before our scheduled departure. This child was hers to name, and she selected one that could be easily pronounced by Greeks and Americans alike, Marina, and a middle name of Zoe, the Greek word for life. We emptied our apartment on West End Avenue, sold our furniture at an apartment sale, and arrived in Athens on September 8th, taking possession of a large rented house with a walled garden in the residential suburb of Neopsychiko. I thought I would have the resources, time, and opportunity to begin my investigation of my mother's fate at once. But as soon as we arrived, a series of international crises erupted that kept me out of the country for almost all of my first 2 years. Political events in Greece had calmed down, but all over the Middle East, violence raged. I found myself shuttling from Athens to Ankara to Beirut. By the spring of 1978, riots in the northern Iranian city of Tabriz were signaling the beginning of the upheavals in Iran that would end 11 months later with the fall of the Shah, and I was sent at once to Tehran. There was a brief period that spring when I was allowed to return to Athens, and during that time, my father decided to visit us. He enjoyed sitting in our walled garden under the lemon, bitter, orange, and fig trees like a king on a throne in his hat, suit, and bow tie, listening to his portable radio play Greek music and supervising the crowd of cats, tortoises, and children that always filled the garden. He had a whole repertoire of Greek nonsense songs that he sang while jiggling the baby on his knee, and he took a sly pleasure in popping his upper plate of dentures out of his mouth with his tongue at unexpected moments, which always evoked delighted screams from the children. I told him that we should go up to the village now that the Judas trees were in bloom and spring had covered the mountains with wildflowers, but he was reluctant at first. Finally, he relented, and I drove him and Joan up to Epiros. But my father adamantly refused to stay with anyone in Leah, insisting that I leave him with some in-laws in the neighboring village of Baburi, while Joan and I went on to Aunt Nitsa's house. The next day I collected him and drove him up a bumpy, unfinished road that was being cut up the mountain in the direction of the Church of St. Demetrios. We went together into the ossuary and lit candles over the rough box containing my mother's bones. Father studied the box in silence for a while. Then he turned to me. "I want you to promise me something," he said. "When I die, I want you to bring your mother's remains to America and bury them next to me in Hope Cemetery. I've already bought the two plots and ordered the stone with both our names on it." "I could do that now," I told him. "We could have the box sent to Worcester on the same plane with you when you go back." He shook his head. "No, I don't want to see her buried while I'm alive," he said. "But promise me you'll do it when I die." I promised, and we walked back to the car and drove down toward the Hades house where Joan, Nitsa, and Andreas were waiting. But when we stopped in the road just above the courtyard, my father said, "I'm too tired to go in. Just bring me a chair up here so I can sit and have a cup of coffee." Nitsa and Andreas came up the road, and we all begged him to enter. But despite everyone's pleas, he firmly refused to set foot through Nitsa's door. In the end, we brought him a chair from the house and put it under a large walnut tree by the side of the road. Joan made him a cup of coffee and brought it up to him, and he sipped it in grim dignity. He was making a public display of the fact that he wouldn't enter Nitsa's house. For that matter, he wouldn't enter any house in Leah, and his behavior was the deepest kind of insult in the Greek view. I was surprised at how much anger he felt for the townspeople and how he had completely cut the village of his birth out of his affections. Since Father clearly couldn't be convinced to spend any time in the village, we left the next day to head back to Athens, where he seemed more content. But soon his old restlessness set in, and he was talking about returning to Worcester. His stomach was bothering him, he said, and he was afraid of getting sick and having to go into a hospital in Greece. He would rather be home near his own doctors. I agreed that was probably best, since I was being sent back to Iran. On the last day of his stay, my father sat with me in the garden and said, "When you come back to America, I don't know if you'll find your father there. But before I die, I want to tell you that I'm proud of two things in my life. The first is all you've done, and the second is that none of my daughters ever shamed me. For that matter, even my nieces, all the Goyotsenas women, they've all been virtuous and never once dishonored our family." I was already irritated at having to return to Iran and at his behavior in the village, and now I blew up at him. What's so important about that? I snapped. Why is your pride and the family honor based on the virtue of its women? You don't think that honor is important? He asked in a tone that intimidated me despite my anger. Yes, honor is important, I replied, but it should be based on what we do as individuals, not on the sexual property of our women relatives. In most families, some girl is going to step out of bounds. Does that mean that the entire family has to lose its good name and self-respect? To me, to my friends and my enemies, yes, he thundered. All the men I grew up with and lived in fear that one of their women would shame them. You could wake up one morning and find out that everyone you knew looked at you differently because some girl in your family did something crazy. That's why I'm proud that none of my daughters, none of the women in the whole family that bears our name, brought shame on me. I can walk with my head held head high before any man I know. I decided to drop the argument. There was no way of knowing when or if my father and I would ever see each other again. But his words helped me understand both his thinking and the societies I encountered on in Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, and Turkey, where women were oppressed and carefully guarded by the men, but carried within themselves the knowledge that they had a weapon that could shatter their entire family in a moment. My father returned to Worcester, and I plunged back into the Iranian Revolution, during which time I saw one of my colleagues, Joe Alex Morris of the Los Angeles Times, shot dead by a stray bullet. I obtained the last interview with the Shah before his flight and watched Ayatollah Khomeini turn the country into a rigid theocracy. As soon as I returned from Iran, I was sent to war-torn Beirut and then to Pakistan to cover the Afghan guerrillas' opposition to Soviet invasion. By 1980, I realized that if I was ever going to devote myself to researching my mother's story, I would have to leave the Times, for covering Middle East hotspots kept me constantly out of the country and used up all my time and energy. In October 1, 1980, I resigned from the newspaper and set out to find anyone involved with my mother's last days. The journey that followed took me all over Greece and to England, Canada, America, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. I interviewed hundreds of people, former friends and neighbors of my mother, villagers who had witnessed her trial, false friends who had testified against her to win approval from the communist guerrillas, and guerrilla soldiers who had carried out the policies that led to her death. While I was traveling in Greece, tracking down witnesses and filling in gaps in my mother's story, my sisters called occasionally to tell me that my father's health had become more fragile and that his memory was going. They had a tendency to exaggerate all illnesses, their own and those of others. And when I paid a visit back to the States in February 1981, my father met me at the airport and I found him as hale and quick-witted as ever. He drove me from Boston to Worcester, and on the way on the Massachusetts Turnpike, he pushed his little silver Omega well above the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. Suddenly, we heard sirens and a traffic cop pulled us over. The young officer asked to see my father's license, and when he returned it, he had a peculiar look in his face. "Would you mind coming back to my car?" he asked me. When we were out of father's earshot, he said, "That license says birthday 1891, is that right?" "That's right," I said, proud that I had a father who could still drive at the age of 90, or 88 if his more probable date birth of 1893 was correct. "Would you do me a favor and drive the rest of the way?" the policeman asked, shaking his head at the thought of someone born in 1800s tooling down Route 90. My father was furious when I told him to move over and give me the wheel. "He told you to drive," he exclaimed. "Why would he do that?" "You know I'm a better driver than you are." "I know it, Patera," I said, "but you don't want him to arrest you, do you? Let's just humor him." "All right, this one time," he grumbled, "but I'm still a better driver than you. If they ever take my car away, that's when I'm going to lie down and die." My father complained all the way home at this injustice, and I was reassured that neither his mind nor his reflexes had deteriorated much, despite my sister's protestations. But after I returned to Greece, he had an accident that put an end to his driving. It was my father's habit to make the rounds every day in his little car, driving from Worcester out to Grafton to check our empty house, letting himself in to see if everything was all right, making himself a cup of coffee, sitting on the porch in the sun for a while, then visiting a few relatives and driving on to Westboro to see how Glykeria and Procopi were doing at their house of pizza. One summer day, while driving along the roads in Middlebury on the old route of his produce rounds, Father collided with a car of a woman exiting from a supermarket parking lot. The accident was a minor one, crumpling their bumpers, and Father exchanged names and information with the woman. But when he arrived at the Westboro House of Pizza, he told Procopi and Glykeria in a state of agitation, "I've been in an accident and damaged my car, but I can't remember where it happened or anything about it." They made him drive back by his usual route, trying to jog his memory, but Father couldn't recall anything. Finally, their son managed to obtain the information from the Department of Motor Vehicles because the woman involved had filed an accident report, but Father was so demoralized by his lapse of memory that he gave in to my sister's insistence that he quit driving alone. He had to stop his daily rounds of visits, looking after the property and activities of extended family, like a ruler overseeing his kingdom. But he wouldn't admit it was permanent. "Nobody touch my car," he would warn the family. "I may not take it out today, but I'm going to take it out tomorrow." But in fact, his confidence was shattered, and he never drove again. And when he stopped driving, he began to die. That August, I received a long-distance call in Athens from Procopi, who told me that my father had been hospitalized for a prostate problem and the doctors had discovered an accumulation of liquid in his lungs that could prove to be life-threatening. "I think you'd better come, Nick," Procopi told me. "His mind is deteriorating fast and he doesn't look good." "That's what you and my sisters are always saying," I shouted angrily over the phone. "But when I come back, his mind is always as sharp as ever. He's 88 and he's in better shape than most 60-year-olds. Despite my protestations, I took the next plane for Massachusetts. When I arrived at Hahnemann Hospital in Worcester, I approached my father's room with misgivings. In preparation for traveling to Iron Curtain countries to interview exiled guerrillas and unfriendly witnesses who had testified against my mother, I had grown a beard to help hide my identity in case any former villagers recognized me through my resemblance to my mother. Now I was worried that my father might not know who I was, that he might have become so senile he wouldn't realize this tough-looking stranger with a beard was his son. I entered the room to see bottles suspended over the bed and tubes running down into his veins. I was shocked at how frail my father looked, small, gray, and weazened beneath the hospital sheets. With great effort, he raised his head a bit to examine me with hooded and intent eyes that reminded me of the hawks in our mountains. He frowned at what he saw, then he raised a trembling hand to beckon weakly to a nurse who was bustling around the room. "Come here, nurse," he croaked in a voice so faint I could hardly hear him. "Get me my jacket from the closet." "Your jacket?" she asked. "Yes, I need something in it." She brought him the jacket and propped some pillows beneath his back as he fished his wallet out of his pocket, still regarding me with a look of distaste. He pulled out $2 bills and thrust them at me. "Here's $2, he said with a sly smile. "Go get a shave. I don't want a son of mine looking like a bum." I was so relieved to find my father's teasing humor still intact that I discounted my sister's claims that he was declining. Within 12 days, his lungs were clear, and he was released from the hospital. Convinced that he was on the mend, I headed back to Greece to finish the research on my mother's murder. By the end of 1981, I was done. I had interviewed more than 400 individuals in 7 countries and was ready to complete the writing of the book about my mother's life and death. On New Year's Day of 1982, I moved my family back to America, settling them in our house in Grafton. On the flight back to the States, they talked excitedly about their new home and country. Of our 3 children, only my 10-year-old son could remember living in America because we had been away for 4.5 years. When we got to Boston, my sisters greeted me with disturbing news. We didn't want to worry you because we knew you were coming home anyway, Glykyria said. But father is in the hospital again. He's very ill. It's the diabetes. He bumped his foot and won't heal. Now it's full of gangrene. My father had had diabetes for many years, controlling it through diet and then insulin. But now he was old, his circulation was poor, the infection wouldn't heal. I went straight to Hahnemann Hospital and was shocked to see how much weight he had lost, about 30 pounds thinner than the last time I had seen him, but he now looked exactly like his older brother photo, except that my uncle, at 97, was much more vigorous than my father, who was 9 years younger but fragile as a child. I was even more horrified when I lifted the sheets and saw the great suppurating wound on his leg. Clearly, the weight of his bedclothes was aggravating the terrible sores. I demanded to see my father's doctor and ask why nothing had been put over his infected leg to protect it from the weight of the sheets and the blankets. We'll see if we can do something about it, said the doctor unconvincingly. But this is normal procedure. Then he told me that they were probably going to have to amputate my father's leg. Amputate his leg, I shouted. The man is nearly 90 years old. He'll never survive. The doctor shrugged. If he didn't respond to medication, there was nothing else they could do, he said. Either they amputated the gangrenous leg or the infection would kill him. Quickly, I made some phone calls and learned that the best hospital in the area for the treatment of diabetes was the Joslin Clinic in Boston. I signed my father out of the hospital in Worcester and rode to Boston with him in an ambulance. In the past, he had liked to tease me every time we parted, telling me, "Say goodbye to your father now. You probably won't ever see him again," always referring to himself in the third person. But now, despite his pain, he saw my fear and took the opposite tack. "Don't look so worried," he chided me. "You're not going to lose your father yet." He was right. The doctors at the Joslin Clinic immediately won my confidence by rigging a cage-like frame over his leg to protect it from the bedclothes. They cleaned the wound and treated him with antibiotics, and within 2 weeks his condition was stabilized to the point where there was no more talk of amputation. My father was much weaker than I had ever seen him, but he exulted in the outpouring of infection that filled his room with visitors who made the long trip to Boston every day to bring him dishes of Greek food and to demonstrate their respect and love for him. Within weeks, father was well enough to be taken home to Maxdale Road, where he was installed on the sofa in Glykyria's basement so that he could lie in the center of the family's activities, surrounded by the bustle of his grandchildren, the conversations, cooking, television, and visitors, and only a few feet from the bathroom. Fastidious and proud as ever, he refused to let anyone bring him a bedpan or help him in the bathroom, but he made the trip by supporting himself with a metal walker. A nurse came every day to clean the wound on his leg and monitor his condition. I dropped by daily to visit, pleased that he had been spared the pain of having his leg amputated. Often, when I came to see him, my father seemed to have slipped the bonds that anchored him to his time and place. I realized that his mind was traveling back through the decades and halfway around the world, transporting him to scenes in the past that replayed themselves within his head like pieces of a movie that had been picked up off the floor at random and spliced together with no concern for chronology. Glykyria said she always knew when he was embarking on one of these journeys into the past because he would sit there trying to thread an invisible needle with an invisible thread. Then he would begin to sew. "What are you doing, father?" she would ask, and he'd reply, "Sewing on a button." "I'll do that for you," she would say. "You don't need to mend your clothes." "No, I want to do it myself," he would insist and continue sewing, like Penelope, weaving the threads of his past together to complete the tapestry of his life. Sometimes when I visited, he was there in Glykyria's home with me, chiding me, as usual, about the scruffy beard and fishing out the same $2 so I could get a shave. But then I would come again and find he was a 10-year-old tinker's apprentice on the island of Cyrus, excited by the news that an English ship had sailed into the harbor and an English lord had disembarked to take refreshment in the cafe. "I want to see him, too. Where is he? I've never seen a real lord," he would say in Greek to an invisible companion. "Let's go. I want to get closer. Where is he?" "But that's just a man. He's a man like anyone else, and such a short man. Imagine, such a short lord." In a way, I felt privileged to sit by his couch and listen to these scenes from his youth at the turn of the century. Perhaps as his journey took him closer to the bridge that separates this world from the next, the shadows waiting for him on the other side appeared clearer to his vision than the adult children sitting beside him. His mother and his dead brothers and sisters were vivid to him. "Here comes my sister," he would cry with delight, referring to the one who died at 16, a victim of the evil eye. "Look how beautiful she is." The faces of his hunting companions when they were all Palicaria in the flower of their strength surrounded him, and he'd shout, "Go get Nichelis. He knows how to flesh out the boar. I'll stay here. They won't get past me." Often he spoke to my mother, and I envied him the ability to see her so close and alive, while I had only my fleeting dreams. "Come sit beside me, Eleni," he would say, patting the space next to him. "Tell me the news from Teolonia. Leave your sweeping. Someone else can attend to that. Sit down for a moment now that I'm here. But why aren't you wearing the new dress I brought you?" By the fall, I had completed the finishing touches on the book about my mother, which I called Eleni. Every day I visited with my father, talking with him about our friends, the grandchildren, the days when he first came to America, and when his children first arrived. Other times he would be traveling in his own memories, and I would watch him as he relived conversations with lost relatives, sometimes fighting with my grandfather or Photo, trying to settle old scores, talking affectionately to his mother and the long-dead siblings who had lived with him in a land under Turkish rule, where men were required to wear the red fez and young women hid their faces in fear of catching the eye of a passing Turk and being kidnapped for the harem. His difficult first days in America passed through his personal movie show, too. The bad times when he had waited in the freezing rain for the shop boss to select the day's workers from the crowd, and the better times when a newspaper or letter arrived from Greece, or a winning hand in the Caffeinian had inspired him to shout, "Hey, Costa, treat the house." As the time my father spent in his private world increased, his body seemed to shrink, as if he was slowly slipping away, nearing that bridge that would finally separate us. But sometimes he was back with me, sitting on the couch, regarding me with the old, ironic twinkle in his eye. "I'm writing a book, Patera," I said to him on one of those occasions. "Another book, I'm afraid. You'll bust your brain someday," he said. What's this one about?" "It's about Mana, my angel wife," he nodded. "You bring me this one as soon as it's out. I'll have all your other books on the shelf right over there." "I will," I promised. As soon as I had a finished copy of the book, I took it to my father, but he had forgotten what I had told him about it. "I already have all your books," he said. "They're over there." "This is a new one," I said, handing it to him. "It's called Eleni." He looked at the front cover and then turned it over and saw the photograph in the back, a family portrait we had taken in 1946 in the brief peacetime between the end of the World War and outbreak of Civil War by an itinerant photographer passing through our village. He had lined us up against a stone wall and set up a box camera on a tripod. Standing in the back row were my three older sisters, their hair in braids, and Aunt Nitsa. In the front row, my mother was seated, wearing a heavy homespun village jacket and skirt, her hair covered by a kerchief. Fotini and I stood on either side of her as she held my right hand with her left. We were all staring solemnly at the camera. My father studied the photograph for a while, perhaps remembering when mother had sent it to him and he had taped it to the mirror behind the counter of the diner where he worked. "My sweet wife," he said finally, then handed the book back to me and closed his eyes, probably seeing her more clearly than he could in any photograph. I put the book on the shelf besides the others I had written, knowing he would never be able to read it. Although my sisters knew that it was about, they also had not yet read it. But in mid-April 1983, a fact-checker arrived from Reader's Digest, which planned to run the 20,000-word condensation of Eleni in two issues of the magazine that summer. A slender, scholarly-looking young man with glasses named Richard Hennessy. He was fanatically thorough in questioning facts. "Are you certain your grandmother's eyes were blue?" he would ask me. "Can you direct me to another person who confirmed that?" After he and I laboriously went through the entire manuscript with a researcher underlining and challenging every detail, he asked me to interview my sisters privately without me along to make sure their memories of these events corroborated mine. I asked Lykeria and Kanta and explained to them what he wanted, and they agreed, although they were somewhat intimidated at being interviewed by a representative of a famous American magazine. Kanta, the most emotionally fragile of my sisters, took two tranquilizers to gird herself for the ordeal. Then she went next door to Glykyria's basement, and the two women sat at the Formica table in the kitchen area as a young man from New York read the condensed manuscript aloud, paragraph by paragraph, stopping every few sentences for them to confirm it was correct. He read to them about the arrival of the guerrillas in our village and the night that my mother and grandmother burned Olga's foot with a heated poker from the fireplace so that she would be too crippled for the guerrillas to draft us at Andartina, and about how they took Kanta instead and finally released her in disgust because she fainted so often. He read how the guerrillas threw us out of their house and turned it into the headquarters in prison where they tortured prisoners and forced them to dig their own graves in our garden. They listened as he related how I overheard guerrillas saying they were going to take the children of our village by force, and how I ran to my mother, who began to plan our escape, only to be forced to stay behind at the last moment. He went over the details of our last goodbye to her as the guerrillas led her away. His voice stumbling, he read how she was imprisoned, tried, and tortured. He described the procession of condemned prisoners being led up the ravine past a spring, and being seen by a little girl who gave our mother water. The sight of the child made Eleni cry. Oh, my little Fotini, where is she? Finally, he read the testimony of a village woman who was passing the ravine and heard my mother's final terrible cry, my children, followed by a burst of rifle fire. The young man hardly started reading the manuscript to my sister when they began to weep, but they bravely struggled on, nodding after each paragraph, telling him, yes, this was the way it happened. The researcher told me later with some embarrassment that before long he was also in tears as he read, moved by their pain. They spent the entire morning working their way agonizingly through the story, keeping their voices low so as not to disturb my father, who was dozing on his couch across the room. He didn't take in much of what went on around him anymore, so they didn't think he would even notice the journalist from New York. But when the ordeal was over and the last words had been read, they turned around and discovered him sitting on the couch, his cheeks wet with tears for his lost wife. The book was published in April. Promotional tours took up most of May, and by the end of June, I was burned out and eager to take some days off. My old Greek friends, Fred Miletus and Tony Deli, from the days we stocked American Girls together in the bus terminal, suggested that we all meet with our families for a nostalgic reunion in Ocean City, where I had spent the best summers of my youth. Fred by now had a whole string of pizza parlors around Philadelphia, and his young Greek wife, Alika, had produced three sons who would someday help operate them. Tony Deli had married a Greek-American girl who gave him two sons, and he owned a large wholesale produce business in Springfield, Massachusetts. We agreed to get together in Ocean City during the second week of July to introduce our children to each other and relive some of our youthful adventures. On the day before we left, I stopped by Maxdale Road to see my father. I leaned over, kissed him, and said, I'm taking Joan and the kids to Ocean City for a vacation, Patera. I'll be back in a week. He nodded, you go, enjoy your family. We're not leaving until morning, I told him. Is there anything you want? Kalo telos, a good end, he replied with a trace of the old fire in his eye. He got his kalo telos 2 days later, the kind of death he would have wanted surrounded by the family he loved. On Sunday, July 10th, Glykeria was celebrating the name day of her husband Procopi, and all the Greeks in Worcester were invited to her house for a buffet supper. The day before the party, she cooked and cleaned like a whirlwind, running up and down stairs. Stay here, my father called to her. Don't clean so much. Sit here so I can see you. You just want to chat, replied Glykeria distractedly. I can't sit around and talk. We're having a name day tomorrow. You should send me to the old age home, said Father, repeating one of his favorite themes. I'm just a burden to you. I make you suffer too much. But when you're my age, you'll want your children to sit and talk to you too. On Sunday, the guests started coming about 5 in the afternoon, and soon there were over 40 people crowded into Glykeria's basement. She had put a hospital bed for my father in a small L near the washing machines so that he could sleep more comfortably at night. But that day he insisted on sitting on the couch in the middle of the festivities so not to miss a thing. Everyone remembers how he laughed and joked that day, teasing his children and grandchildren, scolding one woman because she laughed too loud, and then laughing even louder himself. Father hated the stricture of his diet and kept asking for a plate of garlicky gigantes, beans, and tomato sauce, but Glykeria reminded him that they weren't good for his diabetes. Olga came and sat by his side and fed him some rice. Then Kanta came and held a cup of tea for him to drink. It's good, but what I really want is some of the beans, he said plaintively. A little later, he began to wheeze a bit and said to Glykeria, bring me some cognac or some wine to drink. There's something caught in my chest. Pateri, you know that's the worst thing for your sugar, scolded Glykeria as she brought him a glass of water. She recalled how in the old days he had enjoyed emptying his glass of Retina at parties after balancing on his head and leading the dances. By the time the guests had drifted away, about 11:30 that night, Father had lain down on his bed in the corner. But all the guests stopped by on the way out to kiss him and pay their respects. The sons of my sisters, who had all grown into young men, still went around together like a pack of brothers, and they decided to go out for some fun. First, each one kissed his grandfather. Last in line was the youngest, Fotini's 19-year-old son Christos, an inveterate jokester like his grandfather. Young Christos knelt beside his bed and said impishly, "May you live many years for all of us, Papu. Do you know who I am?" "Who are you?" asked Father, squinting at him. "Christos Botos," he exclaimed, laughing. "My name is Christos, just like yours. I'm your grandson, and I'm named for you." "Yes, yes, my child," Father replied, patting him. "You have my blessing." After everyone was gone, as Glykeria was picking up the dirty dishes, my father moved back from the bed back to the couch in the center of the room. "I want to sleep here tonight," he said. "But it's much more comfortable on the bed," Glykeria said. "No, not tonight. I want to sleep here," he insisted. When she was finished cleaning up, Glykeria lay down on the other couch to sleep, as she sometimes did, for fear Father might call her in the night and she wouldn't hear. She thought he was asleep, but when she lay down and covered herself with a blanket, he asked, "Are you going to stay there?" When she replied yes, he replied, "Good." Glykeria drifted off, but was awakened by my father's jumping up into a sitting position, his feet slamming to the floor. "I don't feel good," he said. "I've got to go to the bathroom." "Wait till I get my slippers on," said Glykeria, but he stood up by himself and then nearly fell. She caught him before he crumpled to the floor, but suddenly his mouth went crooked and she knew he was dying. She began to scream, "Help me, my father, he's dying." Procopoli was upstairs with all the doors closed and the television turned up high, and he heard nothing. But Glykeria screamed so loudly that Kanta heard her from next door and came running over. At the same time, the pack of grandsons returned and found their grandfather lying on the floor while Glykeria screamed. Her younger son, Spiro, tried to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and someone called for an ambulance. When the ambulance arrived, Procopis rode in the back with Father, and everybody else followed behind in their cars, except for Glykeria, who was so hysterical they wouldn't let her leave the house. Father briefly returned to consciousness and indicated with gestures to Procopi to take the wallet from his breast pocket. It contained $400 in cash, part of the small nest egg he had carefully parceled out among the children and grandchildren in his will, allocating $50 here and another $50 there. In the emergency room, the doctors and nurses rushed him off in a gurney. A little more than an hour later, a doctor came out to tell the crowd of waiting relatives The Christos had died of heart failure. He had crossed the bridge to the other side, but not before kissing each one of his loved ones goodbye. About 3 a.m, I was awakened by the telephone ringing in the apartment we had rented in Ocean City. Glykeria told me that my father had died. I hung up before she could say anything else. I needed to grieve for him alone. I didn't know him until I was 9, but God had given me 34 years to learn what a father I had. We buried him on July 13, 1983, in Hope Cemetery in the double plot he prepared so many years before. Hundreds of mourners crowded the funeral home and the church. In the church, the priest chanted, "O Christ, with the saints, grant rest to the soul of your servant, Christos, that he may repose in a place of light where there is no pain, no grief, no sighing, but everlasting life. The beauty of the countenance has withered, and the strength of youth has been cut down by death. Come, you all who love me, and greet me with a final kiss, for never shall I walk with you or talk to you again." We all came forward to kiss his brow and his hands folded over an icon. Because Father never liked to go anywhere without money, case of an emergency, Conta slipped his wallet into his breast pocket with some dollar bills to pay Sharon for the journey to the other side. When we left the church, a funeral cortege, shovel blocks long, followed the black hearse to the cemetery, detouring to stop for a moment outside the house on Maxdale Road, where he had celebrated and received the kisses of all his clan just 3 days before. At the cemetery, we each went forward to throw a flower atop the casket, as the priest and the mourners repeated 3 times, "May the memory of Christos, who is worthy of praise, remain with us forever." Letters came from Greek senators and congressmen. Telegrams arrived from Greece. The obituary in the Worcester Telegram at Evening and Gazette stated that over the years, Mr. Gotsianis sponsored and assisted the immigration of more than 100 people from his native region to the United States. The Hellenic Chronicle devoted an entire editorial column to the former vegetable peddler and cook. For 35 years after his wife's death, Christos Nagianos was both father and mother to their children. It is said Christos Gotsianis was a leader among the Pratapori of the Worcester Greek community for 73 years. He worked hard, achieved all the success any Greek immigrant might desire. His only regret was that his Eleni could not have been with him. She was gone, but her living legacy, their 5 children, 13 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, were there. We pray God grant him much-deserved rest, and may he make his memory eternal among us. 14 months after my father's funeral, he and his Eleni were reunited at last when I brought her remains from Greece and buried them by his side. A new marble tombstone was ready, bearing on one side of their names and birth and death dates in English, and on the other side the same facts in Greek, along with an image etched into the stone taken from their 1926 wedding portrait. My father in his American suit, tie, and hat. My mother in her kerchief and embroidered velvet wedding costume. Engraved on it in Greek and English is a line from St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. Love never ends. You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.